Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live, and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, and leading experts delivering all the essential updates that you need, fast and focused. It's Tuesday, the 17th of September. Coming up on our program, what Gwedimantashe's seismic search could mean for the Karoo Basin, how paleotourism can boost interest in sciences and create jobs, a new 3.2 billion rand campus being built in Pretoria, is this the future of private education, and why X, formerly Twitter, has fallen out of the global media brand rankings. The Mineral and Petroleum Resources Minister Gwedimantashe has published a government gazette inviting written comment on his intention to investigate the subsurface geology of the South Central Karoo Basin. The survey, as I understand, aimed to assess geological risk and examine whether there are enough resources to justify any extraction. I want to give you an expert view now from Professor Raymond Durham, School of Geosciences at the University of the Witwatersrand here in Johannesburg. Professor, a very warm welcome and thank you so much for your time. The potential environmental impact of these surveys in the basin, are they serious? And if so, how would they be mitigated?
Well, Jeremy, thanks for having me here. And this is a very big question that you've asked. And when this idea that there might be a substantial resource of shale gas in the Karoo was first, I suppose, aired, there was a big program, a big study was implemented. It was what is called a strategic environmental assessment. And over 150 scientists were involved with this in it, and covered many different issues, ranging from, you know, the effects on our economy, on energy planning and energy security. But you asked specifically about the impact on the environment, and this study included looking at things such as air quality, greenhouse gas emissions, the risk that perhaps the fracking would trigger earthquakes, looking at the surface and underground water resources, looking at waste planning and management, biodiversity, ecological impacts on agriculture, culture, impacts on tourism, impacts on the social fabric, on human health, the sense of place, you know, the visual aesthetic and scenic resources, heritage resources, the noise that would be generated, and even the interference that this could have to our square kilometer array. So there was already, and this is nearly 10 years ago, a detailed report done, study done, and it runs to nearly 1,500 pages. So there's a lot of thought that's been given to this. And of course, there are risks, and there are also many opportunities to mitigate it. So that provides us, you know, a very solid foundation to go forward.
I understand what the opportunities might be, and obviously in the economic sphere. But what are your concerns about risk? For instance, water scarcity, if fracking is found to be necessary to extract shale gas.
Yes, so the fracking process does involve using quite a lot of, you know, a large amount of water, you know, running to hundreds or thousands of, you'd say, normal swimming pools, suburban swimming pools. And of course, the Karoo is an arid region, and people are dependent on getting groundwater. And so the question is, where would this water come from? Now, there are many options. One is that you could, for example, drill deep holes. Usually the water that is used for agriculture and for municipalities comes from relatively shallow boreholes, which are perhaps up to a few hundred meters deep. But we know there are deep aquifers, kilometers deep, and in order to access the shale in which the gas might be is we'd have to drill deep boreholes. So one option would be to get groundwater from these very deep, very salty aquifers. Another one would be to use grey water from municipalities. You could even, again, depending on the scale of the discovery, think about running a pipeline from a major river like the Orange or even from the sea. So there are options on where we could source the water. Another issue dealing with water, of course, is the water that comes out when you're extracting the hydrocarbons is can be dirty water, can be toxic. And so, of course, it needs to be handled very carefully. First, you don't want any leaking into the aquifers that are being tapped for agricultural and purposes and human consumption. And also, when you treat the water on the surface, this has to be done rigorously. Nothing must escape into the environment. It must all the dangerous products must be well captured and well managed. So that's the whole issue of how do we manage this. And I think on a small scale, of course, one can do it carefully. But when you have literally maybe hundreds of wells happening, and this project would run for decades, the idea is to continually monitor, maintain the very highest standard of management of these sites.
Professor, how do you weigh then the economic benefit versus the risk that you've just outlined to me, particularly considering the boom and bust nature of extractive industries?
Yeah. Now, well, firstly, before any company would invest huge amounts of money in something like this, and it is an expensive business, they would want to, you could say, probably sell ahead a lot of the product that they will be extracting over the next period of time. So this would be, for example, to convert the gas into power, and that's already, you know, it's done quite a standard technology to do that, but they'd want to sell to the municipalities or to the national electricity grid a certain amount. So you'd want to, you could say, tie down some of your output. So you, in that sense, to make sure that you wouldn't end up making a huge loss. And that is normal for any type of, I suppose, major development that involves a large cost, whether it's putting in transmission lines for, let's say, solar power or for wind power. All these things, it's important to, you could say, secure your investment over a longer term. So that is, it would be a part of the whole planning process. And these issues need to be weighed up. Now, what is the, and compared against, let's say, other sources of energy, if you're considering the energy product. Of course, petrochemicals are also useful for making plastics. And again, you'd have to see, are there offtake agreements? Are there people that companies that would buy these products to make the many things that we use for plastics? Of course, we need to move away from single-use plastics, but there are a lot of uses for plastics that are long-term. So again, it's a trade-off. It's like, I suppose, any activity. If you wanted to start a plantation for forestry, that's a, you might think is a good thing, but would also impact on the environment. And it's a long-term investment. You would need to try to make sure that you can secure that investment by securing contracts over a longer term.
Professor, let me ask you one final question, and maybe unfairly, but I'll ask you to nail your colours to the mast here. On balance, do you think this is a good move? Should we be embarking on these surveys for possible gas extraction?
Yeah, at this stage, I mean, we know there is some gas there, but we haven't got a clue as to whether it's technically possible to extract it on scale or economically viable. So I think really we're sitting at a choice here. Do we just close the lid on a Pandora's box, as is done, let's say, in the national parks, where we say we don't want to risk the Kruger Park, so we will not allow any prospecting there? Or is this, or are the opportunities so great? This is an area where there's farming. There are large parts of the Karoo are, in fact, degraded because maybe of overgrazing. There are impoverished communities there. Is there an opportunity there that we need to at least explore so we can make a rational decision into the future? And my personal position would be is that I think, yes, we should explore, but we must make sure that the exploration activities are done carefully so as to minimize any impact on communities or the environment. And should any resource be found, we must make sure that it is managed very well so that we do not pollute our environment and leave ourselves with a sorry legacy.
I do appreciate the perspective in conversation there with Professor Raymond Durheim, School of Geosciences at the University of the Witwatersrand.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you the privatization of higher education in South Africa does remain a hot topic based on the success of the private technical training institution Soltech. The same developer, Canton, is now involved with the construction of a new 3.2 billion rand campus for private Afrikaans Christian University. It's also backed by the trade union grouping Solidariteit. More now from Martinus Visser, who is MD of Academia. And first up then, what's the big plan here?
Yeah, Jeremy, the need for Afrikaans higher ed is just growing immensely. And our vision is to create a space, a friendly and a safe space for Afrikaans students where both their hearts and their minds are formed to become independent, well-spoken and critical thinkers in the context that they will one day work and operate in.
Is the implication there that other existing education facilities are not friendly towards Afrikaans people?
Yes, you'll remember the wave of changes that started in the end of 2015 and 2016, beginning of 2016. It initially started as the Fees Must Fall campaign, and it had many different angles on it. But since then, the language policies at the previous Afrikaans universities changed to English only. So it is a challenge for Afrikaans learners to study and to really engage in higher ed in their second language. So, yeah, I think you might say that.
What about the inevitable accusation that is going to come is that you're simply just retreating into the education lager here?
Yeah, you'll always find that there's so many questions and frowning upon on what we're doing. I think for a start, our opinion is of our point of departure is that there's a huge difference between studying in your mother tongue language and working in an English-only environment. So what we say is that it's of utmost importance that students get the opportunity to form their minds. And, higher ed is difficult. It's big, huge volumes of work, and it's complex ideas that you work with, and it's so much easier if you can do that in mother tongue. So that's the first point I would like to make. And then secondly, we believe that every community must have the right to advance their own education and within their language context and their cultural context. And so that doesn't mean that we're not friendly with regards to other communities. We would actually love to help and to support other communities to do the same. And with regards to other communities studying at Academia, you'll find we're currently planning to open a satellite campus in the Western Cape, and there's a lot of coloured Afrikaans students who wants to study there because they've got the same problem with regards to language at public universities.
But Martinus, you will concede that you're going to have to do a lot of work in addressing the potential race optics given the historical context of Afrikaans education and its associations in South Africa.
No, that's true. That's true. And a lot of work has been done already, Jeremy. We have to engage with other communities, with other language groups, and we're already doing that. There's discussions and forums going on between other institutions within our family of institutions, between institutions like the Mbeki Foundation and so forth. So I think, the way that the work and we engage with other communities shows our position and our openness to work and to be successful in the South Africa that we're in today.
What response so far from the Ministry of Higher Education, and has Academia received full accreditation from the relevant educational authorities just yet?
Yeah, so to that is very important to make sure, Jeremy, that our conduct is absolutely aligned with the regulations and everything that needs to be done to be accredited. And we want to do that. We're doing much more than that. That is only the minimum. And the response has been very good. I must say I think the Department of Higher Ed is very effective. They eradicate quite effectively. Although the processes takes a long time, process of accreditation and so forth takes quite a while. The response has been good and positive, and we understand that universities has to guard their own standard and quality, and therefore we really make sure and we work hard to make sure that our quality is aligned with the regulations of the department.
And that point is well taken, but you're still waiting, if I'm hearing you correctly, for that formal accreditation.
No. So academia has been going since 2012, and the institution has been accredited already in end of 2011.
My mistake.
We started in 2012, and as you roll out new programs, every new program has to be accredited by the Council on Higher Education as well. So we are now in development of new programs for the campus coming in 2028. And of those programs, we are still waiting for outcomes.
3 billion rand to spend on this campus is a lot of money. In fact, over 3 billion rand.
It is.
Where is the money coming from?
Yeah, so maybe I must start to explain how we are set up. So academia is a non-profit. And the reason for that is to keep us true to our reason for existence and our mission, and not be directed by shareholders' objectives. Now, the consequence of that, Jeremy, is that you do not have access to capital. So about 6 years ago, we set up a canton. And we parked all the properties of the Solidarity Movement in Canton. And then we made sure that the properties are rent out at market values. So Canton is now in a space where they can raise capital for this project. They contracted Paladus Capital to assist them in raising the capital, and that project is going quite well. So academia has to make sure that our business model allows us and makes it possible to afford the rentals from Canton, and that looks very, very positive at this stage.
What is the expected size of the student body on this campus?
Yeah, so we designed the campus for 5,000 undergrads, Jeremy, and a couple of thousand postgrads. The postgrads will study in a blended model, so they won't be on campus 100% of the time. Yeah, so that's a student body, and then we're planning to build residences for about 1,500 students, four male and four female residences. And obviously, then on a campus like that, you need to have all the facilities and spaces that is needed for that student body. So we're planning in one section a huge agricultural research facility, and in the same space will be the engineering workshops for the different engineering programs. Obviously, you'll have to have world-class sport facilities, and we're planning that. We're planning a world-class indoor sports center, 50-meter pool, rugby fields, where 15,000 spectators can watch games. Same with an athletic track. There will be two hockey Astros, netball, paddle, tennis, cricket, all those. And the size of the property is about 220 hectares, and it's about 8 kilometers east of the urban edge in Pretoria. And the reason we did that is, if you look at history, many campuses of current universities were developed on the urban edge. And as the city grew closer, these universities got entrapped and didn't have space to grow more. And therefore, we bought this huge property to 220 hectares to make sure that our campus will outlive, all the movement and demographic movements and so forth in the future.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Martinus Visser, MD Academia, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Elon Musk's rebranding of Twitter into X has led to a staggering drop in its brand value, wiping billions off its worth. According to Brand Finance's latest report, the brand's value has fallen from $5.7 billion in 2022 to just $673 million in 2024, and that has caused it to drop out of the global brand ranking. Jeremy Sampson is the executive chairman of Brand Finance Africa. He joins me now. And Jeremy, first of all, then, what's the primary reason or reasons for this dramatic drop?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Good to be with you as always. Yes, I think people forget that Elon Musk bought Twitter for $41 billion with a lot of help from friends and other banks. And at that time, which is about January 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the brand part of it was worth about $5.7 billion of that 41 or so. Now, the value has dropped through the floor, partly because he changed the name without thinking about it, I think too much from a marketing perspective. He just wanted to do it. He hasn't done any sort of branding or marketing evolution of the whole thing, and he's upset just about everyone, you know, especially the advertisers. So today that brand is worth under $1 billion. It's the biggest dropper of all the media brands this year.
Jeremy Sampson, what's the big lesson here in terms of rebranding if you're going to consider a radical name change like he did? What do you need to think? What metrics do you apply here?
Well, the first thing is the name not working. And I think we would all agree Twitter was actually working quite well. The fact that he bought it 2.5 years ago and still people say X Twitter shows how strong that was. But you've got to have a marketing plan. You've got to actually make sure that over a period of time you migrate, and that's the term, migrate your brand from one position to another. And he didn't think about that. Does he care? Probably not. And people say, well, wow, you know, paying $41 billion, that's a hell of a lot of money. But people forget that his worth at the moment as the richest man in the world is $240 billion. So, you know, we're almost talking here petty cash for him. It's a toy. He's almost become a media baron, now using the media in a tech term, not as we would have found 20, 30, 40 years ago as media barons using print. And he is arguably the most powerful man in the world when it comes to the media field now. It's actually amazing when you think about it.
But Jeremy Sampson, in spite of the drop in brand value and also brand strength, and we can talk about that in just a moment, it still for many does remain the instant news media platform of choice, doesn't it?
You're quite right. And this is where it's amazing the importance sometimes of messages being put out first on this channel. The number of very important people who actually don't put out a press release now, they just put out a message on X Twitter. And that's where I have to say I'm finding I have to filter it much more strongly today than I did in the past, because of the toxicity and some of the poison. But this is where he deliberately said he wanted it to be a platform for free speech.
You talk about the importance of the evolution of marketing when it comes to branding. I guess that's not just for a media brand, but it's for any brand. Share some thoughts for me on how a brand goes about doing that, particularly when there is a radical name change like this. In other words, Jeremy Sampson, what should he have done?
Well, the first thing is you have to do research. Everything is now research and data-based. And if something isn't working, if you've got a name that is stuck in the past or you look old-fashioned, you've got to adjust and change. And that's the first challenge. A lot of people will say, well, let's actually try and evolve that brand using this existing name, but by giving it a facelift, by giving it a tweet or whatever. And that's the way sometimes to keep the equity of your brand. But sometimes you have to be totally radical. And that's, I would almost argue, as a last resort, because then you're wasting all that equity, you're wasting the value, you're wasting all the investment of the past. So that's why a lot of people decide to hang on to a name, even that though it might be a little bit idiosyncratic in today's terms, but just refresh the look and the way it behaves.
You talk about the brand looking old-fashioned. Sometimes, though, that's to the point that you've just made. That's a good thing, is that we like that familiarity and even a little bit of short-term nostalgia.
That's true, Jeremy, but you've got to think of the youngsters, the Gen Zs, and the people coming up and who's got the money. And I remember talking to the chief executive of Distell, you know, the old Stellenbosch Farmers Wine and Distillers Group. And he said that when he took over about 5 or 6 years ago, and of course now it's been sold to Heineken, but he said that when he moved in there, he had lots of what he called heritage brands. And he said, heritage brands don't make me money. There are a lot of people who like them. As you say, they have a hanker back to the past, but they're not making money. And that's where a brand today, as we know, has to be totally relevant to all audiences, especially the younger people, and especially today with the way digital has gone, your international audiences. We're not just playing in our own backyard of South Africa.
So we've spoken about brand value, but there's also this concept called the BSI score, which is the Brand Strength Index, which has also gone through the floorboards.
Absolutely. And this is a brand strength. Some people are confused by the difference of brand value and brand strength. And just to remind your listeners that the international standard for brand value, that's the financial value, is 10668. But there is another ISO for brand equity, which is what relates to strength, and that's 20671. So here we're looking more at the perception of the brand, how the brand behaves, what's the investment, what's the trends, how is that brand performing. Now, we can look around ourselves at the moment and see brands which are having difficult times or are fading into the background. They're not relevant anymore. And then there are brands that are really strong and coming up. And, you know, this is where when you actually look at the rankings, I think by financial value, 7 of the top 10 are American and 3 are Chinese. When you look at brand strength, and this is where the Chinese are coming up strongly with WeChat, there are a couple of Korean brands in there, which I've never heard of, and people like Instagram. And then you go down the rankings, and then hanging in there is Facebook at number 10.
What about the likes of Google and TikTok?
Look, Google is obviously part of the Alphabet group, and that's worth $333 billion, Jeremy. It's hugely valuable. But one's got to remember that the Alphabet group, which owns Google, also owns YouTube and Waze and DoubleClick and a whole nursery of others. The other one, of course, to think about is Meta, because Meta owns Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and others. So this is where the power that Facebook has and the power that Google has are still absolutely huge. The influence on the communities around the world is humongous.
Jeremy Sampson, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally, as we acknowledge Heritage Month, the Paleontological Scientific Trust, or PAST, is on a drive to renew interest in South Africa's rich fossil history. Dr. Kimberly Tommy, chief executive of the organization, says getting people interested in paleo sciences is not just a great opportunity for education, but could also boost tourism and create much needed jobs. She joins us now. And why then is this important, and how do you go about engendering more interest?
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I think it's really important for South Africans to reconnect with our ancient heritage, given the current situations that we are facing, whether that be division based on race or religion, or it be the way we treat our environment, and we see that through climate change. So what our ancient heritage teaches us is that we all come from one source, and that all life shares a common origin. And that message is really important given these challenges that we are facing that seek to divide. So I think ancient heritage does provide that deeper insight into our shared common origins. I do think that paleontologists and that people working in the heritage sector have an obligation and a duty to ensure that this knowledge is accessible and that as many people as possible are exposed to the knowledge generated through these scientific endeavors. And I think that's where museums become increasingly important as these vessels for public engagement.
And we, to that end, have a very rich heritage in that respect. Kimberly, are there specific steps that can be taken then to integrate paleo tourism into our broader tourism strategy and maybe even push it to the top of the list or promote it as a key attraction?
Oh, definitely. I think that paleo tourism offers a different experience. I mean, obviously, South Africa is known for its vast natural beauty and for our natural resources. I mean, many people travel to come and see our game reserves, our wildlife, our flora and fauna. But this offers a different kind of experience where we are actually urging people to connect with this ancient heritage and connect with the nature in a way that they haven't really been exposed to before. So I think it adds a layer onto the overall experience that tourists can be offered here in the country. I think the way we elevate paleo tourism is by highlighting some of the amazing sites that we have to offer. Not only are these opportunities to learn and to see things like actual fossils or caves where really prominent fossils have been found, but it also offers an opportunity to bask in that area or that space where important events in either the Earth's history or in our history as a species took place. So in many ways, it's about reconnecting people to the natural landscape through the stories of evolution. I think we do have a really unique opportunity here, but it does involve a lot of input from various stakeholders, and we do need departments like tourism, arts and culture, and science to actually come together to create these unique experiences.
And you've in many ways preempted my next question. How difficult is that, given that raising awareness and support for paleo sciences isn't always easy?
I would 100% agree there that, I mean, this is a science that we know is relatively easy to sell. We just have to look at the success of, you know, commercial products or even films like Jurassic Park. People are interested in ancient worlds that came before them, but it does require a substantial investment. And because this field straddles so many sectors, it does need this input from all stakeholders. And I think that's where the challenge is really getting departments to collaborate so that we can really put the paleo sciences and paleo tourism on a greater platform. That is a huge challenge, but organizations like PAST are willing to work with these other stakeholders within this matrix to try and amplify our paleo heritage. It is already designated as a priority for the Department of Science, but again, this has to feed into tourism and arts and culture.
And I'm assuming there are huge economic and employment benefits.
Oh, 100%. I mean, we already know the economic benefits of tourism, and many of these natural sites and these museums bring in quite a lot of tourism already. So if we look at places like Maropeng, which is the official visitor center for the Cradle of Humankind, you're looking at foot traffic of over 200,000 people a year. And that museum alone is a beacon of job creation within the Mogale City area. And these museums have helped not just establish employment opportunities through the actual museums themselves, but through boosting local tourism within the area, which then sees the rise of B&Bs and restaurants, etc. So we know that the heritage has the ability to bring in people, but it's kind of like a chicken and egg situation where we need to be able to attract visitors with new exhibitions and attractions, but that requires financial investment, and that financial investment comes from foot traffic, but to generate foot traffic, we have to have something good to offer. So museum sector at the moment is, I would say, in peril. We've seen through the COVID-19 pandemic that many museums, whether that be natural history or our struggle history, were forced to close their doors because they were not able to generate any income. And these institutions are so important because they not only preserve and protect our heritage and our history, but they also act as places of learning, places of unlearning, places of discovery and reflection. And that's really important within our society. So I think these museums do deserve our support and do desperately need it. And that's through the general public actually coming out to visit them and through local governments supporting them.
Dr. Kimberly Tommy, we're going to leave it there from the Paleontological Scientific Trust, or PAST. Thank you very much indeed. And just before we put the show in the parking bay, our online poll today, the drop in Twitter X's brand value. I spoke to brand finance's Jeremy Sampson a little earlier. I'd like your view on this. I still use Twitter, not so much, or not in a million years. If you have a view on that, I'll invite you to go to X or LinkedIn. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.